So welcome to the session on weight reduction. Why is it so hard? I have a private practice in the Boston area where I work both with casual exercisers and competitive athletes. And the main reason why people come is to lose 5 pounds or 10 pounds. But weight is a very, very big issue. And many of them have eating disorders or disordered eating, which I'll be talking about in the next session. But this session, we'll be looking at just weight reduction and how I handle the clients that come to me generally totally frustrated. Like, I should be pencil thin for all the exercise I do. So what I'll share with you is the approach that I take, and maybe it'll be helpful with your clients. But I highly recommend those of you who are personal trainers to partner with a registered dietitian who specializes in sports nutrition so that that person can really get the best professional care that they deserve. So let's sort of jump into this topic. Today, we'll be talking about factors that impact weight, looking at some popular diets such as paleo or keto, intermittent fasting. You know, what we know about weight reduction and what we don't know, look a lot at the physiology of hunger, and followed up with some case studies. So the question is, why is weight management so tough? Isn't it just as simple as eating less and exercising a little bit more? It's like, no. If that was the simple solution, many people would be thin by now. We live in an enticing food environment. The foods that are most commonly overeaten are chocolate, ice cream, french fries, pizza, cookies, chips, cake, buttered popcorn. There's a whole bunch of foods, and most of these are highly processed, ultra-processed foods that are just filled with fat and salt or sugar, and they are very attractive. So certainly, food environment makes a difference. And we know that ultra-processed foods are easier to digest. They take fewer calories to digest than more wholesome foods. We live in an environment where we get too little physical activity, thanks in large part to computers and TV screens, and people just sort of, glued to their computer. So lack of physical activity is certainly a major problem. And we know that one key to success is to be physically active. We live in a time where we're sedentary and there's abundant food and there are all these special eating occasions. Fatter Day, Football Sunday, thank goodness it's Friday. And so many of my clients are very good during the week, but they're so bad on weekends. So the questions I might ask them are, why do you feel like you deserve to splurge on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday? What about splurging do you really love? What would the weekend look like if you continued your weekday eating habits? What if you ate more yummy food during the week? And these are all good questions that sort of get them thinking about why they diet Monday through Thursday and then blow their diet Friday, Saturday, Sunday, which is a very common pattern. Now, even athletes can be sedentary. So the question is, what are you doing with the other non-exercise hours in your day? And I've had triathletes that come to me totally frustrated. I'm doing these double workouts. I'm working out 2 or 3 hours a day. Why am I losing weight? Because when they aren't working out, they're resting and they're recovering to get ready for the next workout. So even though they may be doing a lot of exercise for 2 or 3 hours a day, what happens in the other 22 hours of the day? And there's something called the sedentary athlete syndrome that I make them more aware of. So you really have to be aware of compensatory changes in your daily activity. And the day you go to the gym, it's like, oh, I just went to the gym and did an hour workout. Guess I won't mow the lawn today. And it's fascinating to see how the body can compensate for a lot of exercise. You know, do antibiotics play a role in obesity? You know, we know for years farmers gave antibiotics to cattle and poultry because the animals gained weight quicker with antibiotics than without them. Now, does the same thing happen when humans take antibiotics too often? And, you know, very often I'll talk to a client who said, you know, I used to be thin until I got like tonsillitis or appendicitis or some disease or something where they took antibiotics. And then after that, weight became an issue. You just wonder, did it alter their microbiome? Because all that, the microbes that live in our gut, they impact our weight. Stress, depression, how much does that impact obesity? You know, are you happy? Do you feel successful? Are you accomplishing what you want in your life? And these are, you know, important questions to look at the whole picture. So is weight about eating, or is it about what is eating us? Overweight people lose body fat, not because they go on a diet, but because they feed their souls. They take care of their bodies. What percent of weight issues really have anything to do with food? You know, there are many, many factors that are involved in weight and obesity. Your microbiome, gut microbes, impulsivity, sexual abuse is very common, sleep deprivation, loneliness, alcohol, plus the munchies that come with it and sleeping less, endocrine disruptors such as BPA, which is in food packaging. And, you know, there's a lot that we really don't know about food packaging, like the lining on pizza cartons or in popcorn bags, that's is thought to be obesogenic. So is weight the problem or is weight the symptom? Men seem to have a simplified approach to dieting. So weight loss success in overweight or obese men was associated with eating smaller portions, cutting back on sugary soft drinks, eating fewer high-fat snack foods, and consuming less alcohol. And how often do you hear a wife say, you know, my husband, he just loses weight like crazy, you know, simply, whereas she is struggling. I talked to one man and said, Nancy, you know, I lost 30 pounds in 1 year. All I did is I stopped drinking a Pepsi at lunch and at dinner, lost 30 pounds in a year. So men seem to have it a little bit easier than women do. Women, you go to talk weight loss with them and it's so complex, you know, we know that nature prefers women to have more body fat than men. And does dieting trigger feelings of being denied and deprived? PMS cravings, premenstrual cravings for chocolate can easily derail healthy food choices. Exercise makes women feel hungrier. And so it's a whole different conversation with women, many of whom have been dieting since they were in fourth grade, because about 80% of fourth grade girls have been dieting. And so when you have a long history of being denied and deprived, it sets up a whole bunch of triggering situations when it comes to weight. So weight loss success varies from person to person. Physiologically, some people are hard losers. Here's a 6-week NIH study where they cut food intake in half. They had 12 obese people. Those that lost the least amount of weight had a bigger drop in their metabolism compared to the faster losers. The harder losers seem to have a thrifty gene that was like preventing them from losing weight. Is this inborn? Is it developed over time? What's the most effective rate of calorie restriction? If you eat less, like cut your calories in half, does that mean that you're going to lose more weight? Or does it just mean that you conserve more energy? Here's another study looking at why some people are hard losers. So people with obesity tend to sit 2.5 hours more a day than their sedentary but lean peers. And sitting can save these people with obesity 350 calories a day. What we're really talking about is NEAT, which is non-exercise activity thermogenesis. It's what you do when your daily activity, when you're working, puttering around the house, moving, it's not your purposeful exercise. But when a client comes to me and says, oh, if I just smell cookies, I gain weight, I just sort of observe this person. And inevitably, he or she just sits in the chair. They barely blink their eyes. As opposed to the kid that comes in and says, Nancy, no matter what I do, I can't lose weight. And they're just like running a marathon in their chair. So some people are just not fidgety, and the fidget factor makes a really big difference. So when people talk about having a slow metabolism and just gaining weight when they smell cookies, I remind them that it's probably not the metabolism that's a problem, but their just lack of movement. Metabolic rate is actually quite stable, and it takes a certain amount of energy to pump blood, breathe, grow hair. So that is pretty standard. But what changes is fidgeting or being animated. That's can make a big difference. Psychologically, some people are hard losers. You know, is there something about losing weight that would feel scary to you? Having excess body fat might be a good way to rationalize being unmarried. Oh, I'm just fat and ugly. That's why I'm not married. Maybe it helps avoid some real issues and some real sadness. And this is their armor. I've had clients who have said, you know, I'm really afraid of going on another diet because I'm afraid of regaining the weight and failing again. And so there's a lot of psychology that goes into weight management and weight reduction. You know, if people have been sexually abused, that can play into it. So there are many, many reasons that influence weight and obesity that have nothing to do with eating less and exercising more. We do know that teens who diet get fatter. Here's a survey of junior and high school students. About 57% of the girls and 25% of the boys reported dieting. They followed them 5 years later, and they found that dieting was associated with weight gain, overweight status, disordered eating, and eating disorders. And none of their weight control behaviors had any benefits. These teens go on to be college students who gain weight and then into adults. And so we really need to start very, very young with teaching people how to eat appropriately and prevent weight gain, because preventing weight gain is far easier than losing weight once you've gained it. Questions keep coming up about the latest diet. What about the paleo diet? What about keto? Intermittent fasting? Any diet is a set of rules with good foods and bad foods. And generally, the rules include no refined sugar, no white flour, no grains, no dairy. And the question is, do you really want to never eat bagels, pasta, or birthday cake ever again? So we really have to look at sustainability and how long are you willing to go on a food plan that puts you in food jail? How long do you want to stay in food jail? Some people like food jail. Other people, they're in and out of jail all the time. Are paleo and keto a way for some people to manage dysfunctional eating? Now, this is a comment told to me by an ultramarathoner who was raving about his paleo diet. I love my paleo diet. I live on meats, nuts, fats. I eat only very low carb fruits and veggies like berries and spinach. You know, this diet keeps me from binging on bagels, crackers, pasta. I've lost 8 pounds and I feel great. So I consider the paleo diet, like any diet, like I say, is food jail. And for some people, this takes away decisions and it makes life very easy for them. The problem is, are they denying themselves of valuable nutrients? We know with keto, maybe they're low in selenium. They're low in carbohydrates to fuel the muscles. so that there are problems with any restrictive food plan. But, you know, some people do feel great. We're each an experiment of one. What about the keto diet for serious athletes who have to make weight? I mean, there are some athletes like lightweight rowers or ballerinas or gymnasts who really have a lot of pressure to be very, very lean. So would the keto diet help for them? And the research suggests that possibly, you know, a pre-event diet for wrestlers or bodybuilders, gymnasts, athletes in power sports, you know, that keto might be the answer because it's very satiating. And when people are on that diet, they eat fewer calories without feeling hungry. And certainly it's preferable to being dehydrated, using saunas, rubber suits. So these are all questions. And in this scenario, what we don't know is, yes, you can go on the keto diet and lose weight for an event or whatever, but what happens afterwards? And generally for every diet, there's a backlash. And the bigger the diet, the bigger the backlash. So we always have to look at after the diet, what happens. There are costs and benefits to keto diet. Here, the Army was looking into weight management for their soldiers because weight is a real problem to the extent that it impacts, you know, national security. Here's a study with soldiers in a 12-week, you know, three-month training program on an ad lib keto diet. They maintained their ability to perform well so that they could still do all of their fitness drills. They lost about 7.7 kilos and improved their percentage of body fat, so the diet was effective. And in comparison, the soldiers in the normal diet group didn't lose any weight. So it's like, wow, maybe this is good. And there are many other studies showing that, you know, people, keto dieters, in an environment that supports them, can be very positive. Here's another study, this time with endurance athletes, and they were in a 10-week keto study, and they reported that they ran slower so that the diet impacted performance in a negative way, but they lost weight. They reported feeling better, had enhanced well-being, and after the study, they chose to maintain the diet. Caution, you know, keto diet, it might impair bone health. One, where's the calcium? But are there other factors going on that impair bone health? And so with any diet that's restrictive, again, you have to look at the pluses and the minuses, the benefits and the costs. If you compare 14 popular diets, as was done in this journal article, a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized trials done with 14 named diets and control diets, what they found is whether you eat a low-carb diet, which tends to be high protein or high fat, or a low-fat diet, which tends to be high carbohydrate, that they both had similar weight loss over the course of 6 months. The diets that were most effective tended to be Jenny Craig, Atkins, Paleo, Zone, all diets that I consider to put people into food jail, very restrictive. But by 12 months, weight loss had diminished. And people can go on a diet, lose weight for about 6 months, but inevitably by 12 months, they've regained most or all of them back again. You know, here's just a visual of individual results from dieting. And you can see on the left-hand side, how, you know, people lost weight and then they tended to regain, and by the end had regained maybe not all the weight, but certainly part of it. So I always have my clients think about, is this an eating plan that I'm willing to maintain for the rest of my life? Because certainly yo-yoing on and off diets is worse for your health than staying at a heavier weight. Same thing goes with, you know, intermittent fasting. You know, a lot of people these days are really interested in that. And does it fit your lifestyle? Does it interfere with your social life? Are you able to participate in Sunday brunches with your friends? And for an athlete, if you're training in the morning and not eating until the afternoon, how do you fuel up and refuel? Does it optimize muscle building? And, you know, clearly the answers are that it's not really, the intermittent fasting diet is not designed for athletes. We do know that diets do not work. Going on a diet does not teach people how to manage food, stress, and today's food supply. And for people who go on a diet, the only way to enjoy treats is to cheat. You've got Fatter Day, you've got Football Sunday. And eating should not be cheating. Do we even know the best ways to study weight reduction? If you think about it, the well-controlled research studies where they have people in a metabolic ward, they aren't real life. We're the kids' leftover peanut butter and jelly sandwich crusts. Observational studies aren't well-controlled. Self-reported data is highly questionable. Short-term studies are too short. Long-term studies are too expensive. So it's hard to know even how to study the best way to manage weight. We do know that there are different types of obesities and that different types need different types of treatments. So that obesity should be treated as a medical problem. It's not a personal problem of, oh, you're lazy, you eat too much and exercise too little. Change your lifestyle. Some people secrete a lot of insulin. Maybe a high protein diet works better for them. Other people have a low response to fullness. Pre-portioned food might be best. Others have a high response to food cues. They see food, oh, I think I want that. Maybe they just need to keep the food out of sight. Maybe they have a learned preference for junk food, and we have to unlearn that, and this starts very early in life. Some people are binge eaters, so we really need to tailor the treatment to the cause. Why are you binge eating? Is this a psychological issue or is this related to hunger? Other people just hate to exercise, but we need to find pleasurable movement for them. So there's not a one diet that fits everybody, and we really need to approach weight on a very individual basis. Some exercisers get hungrier than others. Here's a study looking at overweight or obese men and women who did supervised exercise for 12 weeks. The weight changes ranged from losing 32 pounds to gaining 4 pounds. That's quite a range from doing supervised exercise for 12 weeks. The successful subjects, those that were successful with weight loss, lost on average about 14 pounds. And they ate about 130 calories less than baseline and didn't have any change in appetite. The less successful subjects lost only 3.5 pounds and they ate about 270 calories more than baseline because they reported that they got hungrier. So that the conclusion was the subjects who got hungrier with exercise ate more and lost less weight. So, and we also know that people who add on exercise don't automatically lose weight, that really weight is more based on a food change than an exercise change. Are there gender differences with exercise and appetite? Here's a study with 18 women who burned 350 calories with either easy exercise or hard exercise. And then the researchers monitored their food intake for 3 days. The conclusion was that hard exercise does not suppress hunger the same way for women as for men. And in fact, hard exercise increases the attractiveness of food for women. You know, how many times do you hear people, oh, I went to the gym, had a really tough workout. Oh, and then I stopped by Starbucks and had a scone and a latte. But many people get hungrier after they exercise. And it's a question that I ask my clients, particularly marathon runners. If they're doing, you know, long runs, they can be ravenous for the next couple of days. And they end up gaining weight and say, am I the only person who's ever gained weight training for a marathon? It's like, no, many people do. Here's a case study of a dieter who gains weight with exercise. She sent me an email and said, I'm 53 years old and I've been struggling with my weight my entire life. About 5 years ago, I started doing triathlons with my sister. I enjoy them, but find it stressful and demanding. I gain weight while training and I'm overweight as it is. I'm looking for a healthy way to train, lose weight, and not always be hungry. She was 5'8", weighed 210 pounds, and her goal weight was 180 pounds. So she had realistic goals. She had three teenagers. She was taking classes for graduate school, so you can see that she's quite busy. She'd train from 7 to 8 in the morning, and she complained about afternoon snack attacks and her bad sweet tooth. As with all my clients, I always ask them what a typical day is when it comes to eating and exercise. And typically, she would get up and either run, bike, or swim for about an hour. And then she would have her diet breakfast, Special K, skim milk and berries. By 11, she was starving, so she'd have a granola bar for a snack. She pushed off lunch, delayed lunch until 2 o'clock. Where she had her diet lunch, a turkey wrap, and she'd treat was a little bag, 100 calorie bag of potato chips. And then between 3 and 5, she would have a snack attack. She'd start off eating healthy almonds, hummus, and then inevitably end up with candy, cupcakes, whatever was around. And then dinner, she'd have her diet dinner, just chicken and vegetables, maybe 1 or 2 glasses of wine, and then she'd get into the fat-free frozen yogurt. She tried to eat only 1,500 calories. She had no idea that she deserved to eat about 2,600 calories. She was just trying to eat as little as she could, thinking the less I eat, the more fat that I'll lose. She consumed only 800 calories between 6 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon. So it's no wonder that she struggled with snack attacks. And sweet cravings are generally a sign that somebody has gotten too hungry. So we talked about how getting too hungry is a real problem. When people get too hungry, they aren't as compliant. And here's an interesting study done with some men and women with obesity. And it was a free living study, so they weren't in a metabolic unit. But they were given the same amount of calories, but distributed differently. When they had, at one time, they had 600 calories for breakfast and then a smaller dinner, and another group had a 300 calorie breakfast and a bigger dinner. Now, the group that had the bigger breakfast, they had 300 calories of breakfast, and then they had 300 calories of dessert, chocolate mousse, cookies, ice cream. And when they had the bigger breakfast, they felt more satisfied because they had more calories. They were less hungry later in the day, and they found it a lot more sustainable. They had fewer cravings for sweets, starches, and fast foods. So in the afternoon, when somebody brought out the brownies, they said, oh, I've already had my chocolate mousse for breakfast. And it didn't talk to them the same way. So when we look at their weight loss patterns, with the 300 calorie breakfast and the 600 calorie breakfast, both groups by the end of 16 weeks had lost about 30, 33 pounds. But what happens in the next 4 months is interesting. Those that with a smaller breakfast, they regained 25 and a half pounds. And so on average, they only lost 7.5 pounds. And the other group continued to lose weight. So they lost a total of 45 and a half pounds. So what this study tells to me is, one, you want to front load to prevent hunger. And you also want to make sure you eat a yummy breakfast so that when goodies show up later in the day, they just aren't as enticing. So you want to fuel by day and lose weight at night, but not delay eating until later in the day. And so while many people try to put off breakfast and push off lunch, and they think that they lose weight when they're exercising. But when we look at the eating patterns of elite runners and gymnasts, research suggests that athletes who routinely undereat during the day have higher body fat than those routinely fuel throughout the day. So I spend a lot of time talking about circadian rhythms and how eating should be a timeline. You eat during the daylight hours. That's when your body expects to be fed. And particularly if you're exercising, again, you're either fueling up or refueling. And particularly if you exercise in the morning, you want to fuel up beforehand and refuel afterwards, which intermittent fasting does not do. And it seems to be, like, say, counter to a good sports diet. We also know that sleep deprivation impacts weight. And when people are sleep deprived, they tend to gain weight. Sleep deprivation and obesity are concurrent issues. Nearly 30% of adults report sleeping less than 6 hours a day. And when they're sleep deprived, this affects appetite hormones. So the hormones that make you feel hungry, ghrelin, are very loud. And the appetite suppressing hormones that make you feel content are very quiet. And we know that with sleep deprivation, food tends to affect the brain. It just sort of excites the brain's pleasure centers. So when you know how when you're tired and you eat a cookie, it's like, wow. And it just lights up the pleasure centers. Sleep deprivation erodes well-being. There are a lot of studies looking at nurses that are sleep deprived. They have a much higher rate of diabetes, cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure. So certainly deep sleep depression erodes your health. And I remind people that sleep is restorative. We need it to align our circadian rhythms. So with dieters, can they simply make sleep more of a priority? And when I'm talking with my clients, you know, maybe they can't get to sleep earlier every night, but maybe they can have identified 2 or 3 nights a week where they really don't have to stay up watching the news or doing social media, but they could make it a priority to go to bed earlier. We do know that when people get more sleep, they tend to eat less junk food. This is a 3-week study with tired, overweight adults. And they had them sleep for an additional hour and a half, 1.5 hours a night for 3 weeks. They reported that their cravings for sweet, salty, junk food dropped by 2/3, 62%. And their overall appetite declined by 14%. Now, if you eat 14% fewer calories, that's a weight reduction diet right there. So, you know, I'm a big advocate of the sleep more, lose weight diet. And we know that for athletes, sleep is so important for optimizing performance. So weight management aside, sleep is important. Are there gender differences when it comes to weight loss? Does exercise help men more than women to control or to lose weight? You know, men are supposed to be the lean and mean hunters. And in this article, men, even those that had a very high level of physical activity, those that had a high level of physical activity had a lower percent body fat. Whereas the women, there seemed to be no relationship between a high level of physical activity and percent body fat. You know, does nature want women to have more body fat? Just in terms of evolution, men are the lean and mean hunters and women are supposed to be fatter and more fertile. So is there a gender difference? Well, this study with supervised and measured exercise suggests that there are no gender differences in fat loss. So both men and women can lose weight. Here's a 12-week study with 35 male and 72 female subjects with a BMI of about 31, which would put them in indicative of them living in a larger body. They measured changes in body composition, appetite, and energy intake, food intake. Males and females both lost about 2.5% of their body fat. So the bottom line of this study was that when exercise is supervised and energy expenditure is controlled, there are no gender differences in response to exercise. And I think that's important for women to know. But, you know, there's a lot of frustrated women, like I say, with their hands on their hip, they say, you know, my husband, he just goes to the gym, adds on exercise, he loses weight like crazy. I go to the gym, nothing happens. Just get hungrier and eat more. The E in exercise should stand for enjoyment, not to be, and exercise shouldn't be just to burn off calories. So I separate exercise and weight. I want my clients to exercise, but for the right reason. I want them to train, improve athletic performance, exercise to feel good, relieve stress, improve health, build muscles. There's a zillion reasons to exercise. But exercise shouldn't be, oh, I'm fat. I need to go burn off body fat. I need to go to the gym. And it's like punishment. And that one is not sustainable. And it's very important for people to learn to find, you know, joyful movement that they can enjoy and not have exercise be evil or excruciating. Exercise should not be motivated by the desire to burn calories. So when I'm talking with my clients, I talk a lot about eating. Eat more breakfast, eat more lunch, eat more during the day. So inevitably the question comes up, how much is okay to eat? You know, what is an appropriate calorie intake that will prevent extreme hunger, result in loss of body fat, yet allow adequate energy to exercise? You know, some people go to weight loss apps to find their calorie guidelines. And weight loss apps, you know, they can be educational. Maybe they're good for 2 or 3 days. They help people be more accountable. But weight loss apps can actually be harmful as well. They really don't help with stress management or problem solving. They disconnect people from their bodies. And users can feel very controlled by the app. I mean, I had one client who was sort of scrolling through his Fitness Pal thing, and he goes, oh, I've got 500 more calories that I can eat. I said, are you hungry? He goes, no, but 500 more calories. Fitness apps also have self-reported input. You know, how accurate is that? You know, how many people know how many ounces their apple is? How many ounces is in their chicken breast? And research suggests that it really doesn't lead, recording using these fitness apps doesn't lead to greater weight loss. My experience is that they're great for my business. I mean, they get people really, they really control people. And people, particularly with obsessive compulsive disorders, OCD, they really need to stay away from them because it just overruns their life. So yes, educational for 2 or 3 days, but after that, I'd rather have people listen to their body. When I'm with my clients, I do talk about calories, their energy needs, and sort of divide it into different segments. So the body needs fuel to function. It needs fuel for the resting metabolic rate, just lying in bed, breathing, doing nothing, which you see the calories needed to be alive, the brain, heart, kidney, lungs, liver. It could be 1,400 calories for somebody who weighs about 150 pounds. So generally 10 calories per pound times body weight is what equates to the resting metabolic rate. Then you need more calories for your daily coming and going. If you're a mom, you know, chasing after toddlers, or if you're just sitting in an office doing desk work all day, are you fidgety or not? And then more calories for purposeful exercise. So I give my clients a calorie budget and don't want them to get obsessed by it. Like some people, we don't talk calories because I know they're too OCD. The bottom line is that the body is the best calorie counter. So the goal is to listen to your body and to figure out, does my body need this food? And to eat mindfully, intuitively, to honor hunger. You know, little kids, they eat when they're hungry, they stop when they're content. They do not weigh their food, measure their food, count their calories. They can intuitively eat when they're hungry, stop when they're content. And so as babies, we could all do this. And then when people start dieting, 80% of fourth grade girls have been on a diet, they dysregulate. They do not eat when they're hungry, and then they don't stop when they're content. And so it's very important to get back to doing this all intuitively. But knowing the calorie budget, and if someone has 2,400 calories, then they can knock off 10% and divide that into their food buckets, and they have a context. So when they look at 200 calories on the energy bar and go, oh, that's too many, well, they know the context. So counting calories should be a teaching tool, but not an obsession. It should become needless because the body can regulate proper calorie intake. But I want my clients to listen to their body, to learn about hunger, fullness, and their own personal hunger spectrum. So when I'm with my clients, we talk about a hunger spectrum where starved is on one end, stuffed is on the other end, content is in the middle. So if starved is 1, stuffed is 10, content is 5. I focus a lot on 3, which I define as being cold, tired, bored. Oh, I'm just eating these pretzels because I'm bored. Moody, unable to focus, easily irritated. And I'll ask my clients, does that sound familiar to you? They go, yeah, that's where I live all the time. I'm always hungry. And cold, tired, bored, moody, unable to focus, easily, that is hunger. And most people think that hunger is stomach growling. That's starved. That's too hungry. And that is what triggers binges. And binge eating is a huge problem among dieters, and it's a huge problem among hungry athletes. So hunger is a signal that the body needs fuel. Hunger simply means the body saying, I burned off what you gave me, may I please have some more food? And it does not mean, oh no, I'm going to eat and get fat. But hunger simply means the body wants some more fuel. The job is to prevent hunger, because people who get too hungry, they tend to crave sweets. They want quick energy, or they want fats, concentrated calories. When people get too hungry, generally they make unhealthy food choices. I mean, if I'm too hungry, do I want an apple? It's like, no way. I want apple pie with ice cream. And when people get too hungry, they can easily overeat. So I talk about the physiology of hunger, and I want them to front load their calories, to eat enough at breakfast and lunch to prevent the hunger that strikes in the afternoon or in the evening. Hunger is indeed physiological. Some people think, oh, I'm hungry all the time. That's just a personality quirk. It's like, no, hunger is physiologically. And here's the analogy. You know, if you hold your breath for too long, you'll gasp for air. So I tell my clients, you know, if I were to stick your head underwater and keep it there too long, when you popped up, could you breathe normally? They go, no. I'd be gasping for air. Well, you know, if we withhold food too long by dieting at breakfast and lunch, you know, can you just walk by the pan of brownies? It's like, no way. You'll grab for food. And that is physiological. And so it's very important to honor hunger. you will never win the war against hunger. Well, people with anorexia, I mean, they win it, but at what cost? And it just consumes them. And that's really a psychological disease. But for the average person, you'll never win the war against hunger. You might do it for a day, a week, a month, a year of dieting, but inevitably it comes back to bite you. So to lose weight without intense hunger, you just chip away 10%, maybe 20% from total calorie needs, and then divide those calories evenly throughout the day and just chip away at gradual weight loss. You can lose weight quickly by starving yourself and regain it quickly, or you can lose weight slowly and lose it forever. So I'm of the chip away, lose weight slowly plan. So if a person maintains weight on 2,500 calories, you knock off 10%, 20%, 250, 500 calories. So I would have them losing at 1,900, 2,200 calories a day. And at this point, my clients start looking at me as though I'm crazy and their eyes glaze over and they're thinking, I could never eat that much. You know, if I can't lose weight on 1,200 calories, how could I lose weight on 1,900, 2,200 calories? It doesn't make sense. Well, it does make sense because they're probably dieting, blowing it, and they aren't consistently in an energy deficit. So I take the calories, divide them up, again, eating's a timeline, and you get a food bucket every 4 hours. So maybe breakfast at 7, lunch at 11, second lunch at 3. You know, if you eat lunch, an early lunch, what do you do until dinner? You have a later lunch. And I change that word snack to second lunch, or sometimes an early lunch and a later lunch, or lunch one, lunch two, and then dinner. And by talking calories, they have a context of how much is okay. So when they're just trying to eat an English muffin for 150 calories for breakfast, they go, oh, Nancy says I need 500 calories. I need English muffin with peanut butter and a banana and a latte. It's like, wow, you know, that's a lot more than Special K and skim milk. So, and then I teach them how to fill up their food buckets. So they get a food bucket every 4 hours and divide their calories. And the bucket can be divided. So if they work out in the morning, maybe they have part of their bucket beforehand, part of it afterwards. So maybe they have 100 calories before and 400 afterwards. If they're working out in the afternoon, they have their breakfast, their lunch, and then their second lunch, maybe that's fueling up and refueling. Calories are 0, 50, or 100. So I do not want them using, you know, apps that say 87 calories in the apple and 32 in the green beans. No. 0, 50, or 100. And they can use food labels. So the slice of bread that's 110 calories, no, it's 100. The slice of bread that's 90 calories, it's 100. This is not an exact science, but there's a concept here of knowing that it's okay to eat this much, and this is how it feels. So they're eating breakfast, eating lunch, eating a second lunch, and the goal of the second lunch is to ruin their appetite. So then at nighttime, they can eat less. And all those after dinner snacks that they're eating, actually all those calories are just moving to earlier in the day in the form of real food. I want them to include at least 3, if not 4 kinds of different kinds of foods at each meal. So they need grains to fuel their muscles, protein to build and repair their muscles, fruit and vegetables for vitamins and minerals, and dairy or calcium-rich food for bones, and like I say, helps to keep blood pressure down. I want some healthy fat in each bucket. And nuts and peanut butter, in my opinion, are some of the best diet foods around. They're satiating. They've got protein and fiber, which are satiating. And the fat stays with them so that they takes longer to empty from the stomach. Nut eaters do not have more body fat than nut avoiders. The nut industry has studied this. But nuts are anti-inflammatory. And we know that people that have nuts or peanut butter 5 or more times a week reduce the risk of heart disease by 20 to 50%. That's pretty powerful. And that a handful of nuts a day, instead of eating a less healthy snack, can certainly fit into a winning sports diet. So as they're spending their calories, we want to make sure that they're healthy, satiating, and preferably closer to the earth, less processed. So when people come to me wanting, I want a food plan, I have them plan out their food plan. So breakfast, we set up a little chart. Okay, what do you want? You've got 500, 550 calories to spend. So you have a packet of oatmeal, 1.5 tablespoons of peanut butter, put in a banana, a piece of fruit, 100 calories. A latte, 100 calories. Bread, lunch, maybe it's bread, turkey, carrots, cheese. So many foods these days have food labels. If they don't, like I say, piece of fruit, 100 calories. If it's a piece of fruit, it's 150 calories. Or if it's a little kiwi, it's 50. A head of lettuce is 60 calories. So a salad, 50. If it's a salad, maybe it's 100 with everything in it. But this is not an exact science. It's nothing to get obsessed about. But by sketching this out, using the foods that people normally eat, then they can see how they were been under eating at breakfast and lunch. And then it's no wonder that they're overeating later in the day. So we just want to smooth this out. So here's a case study of a weight conscious collegiate male rower. He comes to me saying, I gained 15 pounds that I just cannot seem to lose. And he was totally frustrated. I asked him what a typical day was in terms of eating and exercise. And many of my clients say, should I keep food records before I come? And I say, no, just be thinking about what you typically eat in a day. Because when people keep food records, they change what they're eating. So, how accurate are they? So typically he'd get up and row, train between 7 and 8:30 in the morning, and then come back and have oatmeal, melon, scrambled eggs for breakfast, a good breakfast. By 11, he was hungry, so he had fruit, a piece of fruit, if not more. He had class, and then at 1, he was able to eat lunch, but he'd have his diet lunch, a turkey wrap and a piece of fruit. By 2, he was low on energy, looking for some coffee. By 5, he was like looking for more fruit. Then he'd have his diet dinner. And then at nighttime, he'd eat the whole jar of peanut butter. He'd eat the whole box of granola. He was starving. So he tried to eat 2,000 calories. He had no idea that he needed 3,600, 4,000 calories. So again, he was cutting his food intake in half. And when I work with my clients, I ask them, do you know how many calories you deserve to eat? And generally they don't. They just know how many calories they try to eat when they're dieting. They have no context. So we looked at his food buckets and gave him a food bucket every 4 hours, about 800, 900 calories. That would be a chip away weight reduction plan with 3 to 4 kinds of foods in each bucket. Protein to build and repair his muscles, grains to fuel, fruits and veggies for vitamins, calcium-rich food for the bones. Came back a week later, and he said, I've been letting myself eat a satisfying breakfast with eggs, cottage cheese, oatmeal, and fruit. I feel content, not stuffed. I have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and a glass of milk for my second lunch. I feel calmer, less anxious, less worried about losing control of food. And I've even lost weight. Amazing. He couldn't believe he was on the eat more, lose weight diet. And he wasn't really eating more. He was just eating more that he acknowledged. 4 weeks later, he comes back. I keep waiting for a binge to come, and it hasn't. I have a jar of peanut butter in my room that's lasted 1.5 weeks instead of 1.5 days. I have a box of granola that I haven't devoured in one sitting. I've lost about 7 pounds without even trying. I feel so much better about myself. And I've been rowing really well. Food works. Fuel by day, diet by night. Prevent hunger. So the teaching points, fuel by day, diet by night, lose weight when you're sleeping, not when you're training. Eat on a schedule at least every 4 hours. And for some people, if their schedule doesn't accommodate an early lunch and a later lunch, maybe they have breakfast snack, lunch snack, dinner snack. So I have like three food buckets that they can divide out. It really, like I say, there's many ways to do this, and it's all personalized. But eating on a schedule is important. Preventing hunger, critical. Eating the food you truly want to eat in proper portions. You know, do you truly want Special K? Or do you truly want, you know, grape nuts and granola mixed together? 200 calories, 200 calories. And the goal is to wake up ready for breakfast, not starving at 4 in the morning or 2 in the night, which just means that you just say way too little at dinner. But you wake up, it's like, yeah, I think I want something, a handful of something before I go off for my workout. Or, oh, I think I'll have breakfast now instead of wait for 2 hours. Here's another case study of a dieter who has regained weight. 5 feet, 5 inches, and the highest weight is 242 pounds 4 years ago. She says, I've dropped to 185 pounds 2 years ago with a low-carb Atkins diet and no exercise. You know, I've regained some weight, and now I'm 210 pounds. I recently started doing CrossFit 6 days a week so I can lose fat, get rid of my bulges, but I am struggling. I've been trying to eat 1,300 calories. I am starving all the time. I get so cold that I wrap myself up in a blanket at work, and people call her the blanket lady. So currently she weighed 210, and that put her at a BMI that she says, that's obese, and that just really bothered her. Her goal was to weigh 150 pounds, which is what she weighed in college, at which point her BMI was 26. She had a sedentary job where she worked from 7 in the morning till 6 at night, and then she had grad school on the weekends. She did CrossFit at nighttime after work, and she recognizes that she's gotten a lot stronger, but she really hasn't lost weight. Her dad's side of the family, I always ask my clients, how do you look compared to other people in your genetic family? She said, well, her dad's side of the family was morbidly obese. And she acknowledged that she takes after her dad's side of the family. She's dieted all of her life. She's attended Overeaters Anonymous and convinced that she is a foodaholic and that she has no control over food. Her typical day, which was gluten-free, that was her latest thing. Maybe gluten-free diet will help me lose weight. On her typical day, she was hungry all the time. She drank a lot of coffee. She'd get up at 5 in the morning, have cornmeal and 2 scrambled eggs for 300 calories. By 9:30, she was snacking on cheese cubes and grapes for another 200 calories. Her lunch was broccoli and turkey burger, 200 calories. 2 o'clock, more cheese cubes and grapes. 4 o'clock, almond milk and chia and protein powder. And that gave her, got her to the gym where she did her CrossFit, where she burned off at least 500 calories. And then she'd have her turkey burger and broccoli, plus a lot more, because she was kind of blowing it. She tried to eat 1,300 calories. I estimated that she needed at least 2,500, 2,800 calories. So again, huge discrepancy. That was not the Chipaway diet. No wonder she was hungry all the time. So we talked about how eating a semi-starvation diet is abusive. Stop it. You know, if you were babysitting and your little kid was crying because it was hungry, if you didn't feed that kid, it would be called child abuse. So if you are hungry all the time and starving yourself, stop it. It's abusive. And she needed to allow herself an appropriate intake of eating just a little bit less food. So her schedule required that she have breakfast snack, lunch snack, dinner snack, 2,100 calories. And we talked about how she was actually lean for her genetics. And when we asked how she looked compared to other in her family, she was leaner than everybody else, far leaner than everybody else. And I told her, I think that you're lean for your genetics. She says, yes, I am lean compared to my dad and his family. But my skinny mom has always told me that no one likes fat people. So I've always tried very hard to not be fat. So like, whoa, that skinny mom needs a few lessons needs to love her daughter from the inside out and stop judging her and shaming her from the outside in. I saw her a week later and she says, I feel like a dog who's been let out of a cage. I'm eating 700 calories more than I was, and I'm not hungry and cold all the time. I even took off the blanket. People said, where's your blanket? I gave her an article about starvation and the physiology of starvation. She said, reading that article about starvation was really helpful. I am eating more, but I'm not overeating. I even enjoy just one slice of pizza. Maybe I'm not a compulsive overeater after all. I am just so happy to discover that I am not a compulsive overeater. So I encouraged her to keep experimenting, learning from the day. At the end of each day, what went right? What went wrong? What did I learn? What do I want to do differently the next time? And keep practicing eating intuitively. Does my body need this food? And to enjoy eating appropriate portions of any food she wanted, including her trouble foods. And when a food has power over you, when it's a trigger food like peanut butter, it means that you like it. You liked it as a kid, you like it now, you will like it in the future. So let's have peanut butter every single day, maybe every single meal until you get sick of it and take the power away from it. So I talk a lot about how to take the power away from food with my clients. In her next follow-up, she says, I am doing great. I'm trying to get more sleep. I'm far more relaxed about food. She said, I haven't lost weight, but I feel so much better. So she was content to not have lost weight, but just to have quality of life. So the teaching points for her were to appreciate her body for all the good things that it does for her, to stop comparing and despairing. Because when you compare your body to others, like to your skinny mom, you're going to despair. And I suggested some good books for her to read on body image. www.edcatalog.com is a wonderful resource with lots of good books on body image, dieting, or anti-dieting, healthy eating, and how to manage weight issues. So what I am an advocate of is the small changes approach to weight management. And this is a national weight gain prevention program where you just eat a little bit less a day, you walk a little bit more, add a couple hundred steps a day. And research with healthy, overweight adults indicates that they can successfully follow this plan because it's sustainable. And what we really need to do as professionals is to teach people that diets don't work. People who diet are heavy. People who eat are thin. And that eating is the best way to manage weight and to eat healthfully and appropriately. So my concluding words of wisdom are to eat wisely and exercise enjoyably to enhance health. We want our clients to be as nice to their bodies as they are to their car. You have a car, you put gas in it, it goes. You have a body, you put food in it, it goes a lot better. To remember that no number on the scale will make you happy. And to appreciate your body for all the good things it does for you. It does CrossFit. It lifts heavy weights. It runs marathons. And just to appreciate all the good things your body does for you. And not to struggle on your own. But I highly recommend that athletes that do struggle or fitness exercisers that struggle to consult with a sports dietitian, with a registered dietitian who specializes in sports nutrition, preferably that has the CSSD after their name, which is Certified Specialist in Sports Dietetics. And we want, our clients to get the best care that they can. And registered dietitians have 4 years of undergraduate work, probably a master's, and always an internship. So they have a lot of education behind them that can help clients to be able to manage weight and move forward with their lives, having quality of life on all levels, on the level of food, health, and just being satisfied. For a referral network, if you're a trainer who wants to refer someone to a sports dietitian, I suggest that you go to scandpg.org. SCAN is the Sports and Cardiovascular Nutrition Dietary Practice Group of the Academy of Nutrition Dietetics. There's a referral network, so you can find people in your, a registered dietitian in your area. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. If you want more information, my sports nutrition guidebook has a whole chapter on a whole section on weight reduction and dieting gone awry. It also has sections on just day-to-day eating on the run, how to manage the American food supply. But it's a resource. You don't have to read the whole book. You can just go chapter by chapter looking up the topics that are of interest to you. If you have specific questions, you're welcome to email me at nclarkrd@rcn.com. So eat wisely and well, enjoy your high energy, and appreciate your body for all the wonderful things it does for you.